Well, good evening. My name is Nick Caldry. I'm the head of the Department of Media and Communications at LSE. Welcome to this evening's departmental public seminar. And we're delighted to welcome this evening, fresh from Cape Town, Professor Herman Vassman, who is Professor of Media Studies and Director of the Centre for Film and Media Studies at the University of Cape Town, South Africa. Professor Vassman worked first as a journalist, and in his academic career, he's taught in both the UK and in South Africa. He is a leading world expert on media in post-apartheid South Africa, on digital journalism, and on journalism ethics. And he has more than 60 articles in peer-reviewed journals and more than 35 book chapters. His books include Tabloid Journalism in South Africa, Indiana University Press, 2010. A number of influential edited collections, including Media Ethics and Justice in the Global Age, with Palgrave, 2015. Reporting China in Africa, Routledge, 2014. Popular Media, Democracy and Development in Africa, Routledge, 2011. And most recently, and most relevant perhaps to this talk, Chinese Media and Soft Power in Africa, Promotion and Perceptions, with Shaoling Zhang and Winston Mano, Palgrave, 2016. He's held a Fulbright Research Fellowship at Indiana University in the United States. He's been a visiting professor at Tsinghua University in Beijing and an invited speaker in many parts of the world. He's also the lead partner with our LSE department here in developing our new two-year master's degree in Global Media and Communications, joint with the University of Cape Town, and some of you will have seen leaflets of that from the LSE end. We also have some leaflets from the Cape Town end, if you want to pick those up later. And finally, a particular pleasure to me, Herman was with me a co-author, one of 15 authors, no, 17 actually, in the chapter on media and communications in the International Panel for Social Progress, which is open for public comment right at this moment. And as a respondent to his talk, we're pleased to have Dr. Bingchun Meng, who is Associate Professor in the LSE Department of Media and Communications and an expert on the political economy of media and of Chinese media in particular. So now please welcome Herman to talk about China's media in Africa expansion, perception and reception. Welcome to LSE.
Thank you very much, Professor Kuri, for that warm welcome in the cold London. It's great to be here, and thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you tonight. I will speak a little bit. Let me first give you an outline of the talk. The talk really comes out of a project, a three-year project that we're working on at the moment, funded by our National Research Foundation on, we call it South African Media, the New Geopolitics of Communication. So although I focus on the China-Africa and maybe more specifically China-South Africa relations, we're also interested in broader issues of shifting geopolitics and how that impacts on media. So I'd like to say a little bit about why I think it's a significant area for research, why we've been doing this, speak a little bit about the broader picture of the geopolitics, and then those three aspects of the talk. Firstly, the expansion, looking at giving just a brief overview of Chinese initiatives in the media landscape in Africa, again, focusing more specifically on South Africa. Then moving on to perceptions, looking at some of the implications of this involvement and particularly the debates around this involvement. The reception, how journalists, as an influential group of stakeholders, if you want to use that term, how they reflect on this relationship or this growing engagement, and just touch very briefly on audiences as part of the work that we are still conducting research on. This is also tonight's talk will draw mostly from a forthcoming article in Journalism Studies with Danny Madrid Morales, who assisted me with this, so I have to just like to acknowledge his work in this regard as well. But it draws also, and I'll make some reference to other studies that preceded this particular piece of work. So let me start by significance. Why is this something that I would argue it's very important to research from a perspective on media in Africa. And firstly, I think it is important because it foregrounds a number of assumptions about the media in Africa. In fact, I think although we look at Chinese media in Africa and Chinese media in South Africa, it tells us actually sometimes more about assumptions about African media or South African media. It highlights, illuminates some of the discourses and assumptions around things like press freedom and democratic values. So often debates around Chinese involvement in the African media are actually debates around African media, debates about what we expect of the media in African democracies. And so it's used sometimes almost as a proxy for other debates. It also impacts on Africa's global media image, and that's an area that some people in the audience tonight also have done important work on recently, and I'll pause at that point a little bit about talk a bit more about that as well. So the Chinese involvement in Africa tells us about something about China's aspirations, something about China's desire to expand, but it also tells us about how Africa features in global media discourses and in Western discourses. A third point, the third reason why the China-Africa engagement is important to pay attention to is because it highlights Africa's location in global flows and contraflows of media, global shifting patterns of globalization of the media. So it gives us provides us with a lens to look at these things, and it prompts us to reflect on normative frameworks for African media. So in other words, the China-Africa engagement is in the first instance about a set of relationships between two regions, two countries, if you talk about South Africa and China, but it also provides us with a lens through which to examine some of the assumptions and the discourses that are often implicit. It makes explicit some of these implicit assumptions about this, the African media. So let's look at the geopolitics of communication firstly. China's increased media presence in Africa in the past decade should not be viewed as something that's just happened overnight. It comes on the back of a long history of China and Africa, and I won't go into much detail here, but during the Cold War period, also during the anti-colonial, anti-apartheid struggles, China's had a long involvement in Africa. And also on the media front, China's, during the Cold War, there was some Chinese involvement in African media, in the African media landscape as well. So what we see really should be seen as a return and an intensification of Chinese involvement in Africa rather than a completely new entry. And if we look, take that broader, longer historical view, it also helps us to understand something about some of the historical loyalties that are re-emerging in this relationship. Secondly, if we talk about the geopolitical landscape, it's important to consider other alignments of which especially South Africa has been in recent years been involved with. The BRICS alignment, for instance, and some of this research also comes out of other projects, like we've worked with Daya Thuso, who's also in the audience tonight, on the broader BRICS group of states, emerging states, that have also highlighted some of the shifts, the geopolitical shifts, and how that have impacted on the media. So what Fareed Zakaria has called the rise of the rest, so shifting patterns that show us that the old way of thinking about metropoles and margins have changed. And I think the China-Africa relations again provides us with a lens to think through those shifts. Very recently, we've seen a major political shift, of course, in the U.S. With the election of Donald Trump. We are still to see what the extent of the impact of that the outcome will be, but certainly it looks like Trump will not be as his foreign policy will not maybe be as active in Africa, for instance, as it had been in the past, talking about maybe withdrawing from the AGOA agreement, and that again might create new opportunities for China to intensify its relationship in Africa. So these sort of developments, ongoing developments in geopolitics, also impact on global media flows and contraflows. So China's engagement in Africa should also be seen against the background of broader investment, aid, and political strategies. And these are wide-ranging and complex, and they are, and we shouldn't make the mistake of seeing them in simplistic and one-dimensional ways. They play out in many different platforms, take many different forms in different African countries. They're not all led necessarily centrally by the state. A lot of them are sort of just on a level of business and individual migration. So there's a lot of different dimensions to this. But certainly the more official Chinese Sino-Africa relations around media should also be seen as part of a broader strategy. So the role of the media to enhance what's mentioned in the FOCAC action plans to enhance mutual understanding and friendship is a key part of the what's also been called the upstairs relationship, the so-called relationship between state and state relations. But there's also a lot going on the so-called downstairs and just everyday relationships that often aren't captured in these broader pictures. And that, I think, is also a challenge for research, and certainly for media and cultural studies research going forward, is to look at these sort of everyday relationships and how they also impact on mutual understanding. So in all of this, all of these broader geopolitical shifts, the broader investment strategies, aid and investment political strategies of China and Africa, the media form a key part of those strategies. The media are used sometimes to counter stereotypes. So they're part of a sort of soft power strategy, but they're also used to counter stereotypes and to promote China's going out strategy, China's strategy of going out in the world, and that is underpinned by media strategies. So it's been seen in different words, concepts used to describe that process. Kulancic talks about a charm offensive, Chinese attempt to use the media to polish its image abroad and to provide a more favorable reception for its trade, investment, and political strategies. But people like Anbin Shi have been saying this is really the media is also a charm defensive, because there's so much negative perceptions out there already that the media can only hope to be a defense to some of the negative perceptions that are out there. And I'll return to some of those negative perceptions in the way that they also feature in African reporting. And then, of course, the concept of soft power, Joseph Nye's idea of soft power, whether that is, and there have been many debates around whether that is, in fact, the most useful way of looking at this, but that certainly is also part of the understanding, some of the analyses that have come out to try and understand how the media is playing a role and how the media is linked to these broader economic and political strategies. So when we look at the Chinese media in Africa, we should see that as part of a much broader thrust of China into Africa, and it is equally as controversial. So Chinese involvement in Africa has been controversial in the areas of mining, textile, agriculture. I mean, there's been a lot of criticism, a lot of maybe also sometimes simplistic ways of seeing this, is asking whether this is a new imperialism, whether China is friend or foe. These are very binary ways sometimes of seeing Chinese investment and Chinese involvement in Africa. And just like in other areas of involvement, the media involvement has also been multifaceted. There have been loans and aid and development cooperation, media assistance. But what our study and what I want to report on tonight, the sort of more recent dimensions of our study want to point to, is that there's also a commercial dimension to many of these engagements that often are left out of view. So it's not only the sort of, again, these sort of broader state-driven loans and cooperation but also commercial dimension to it. And two reasons for that, and that is Chinese media companies wanting to increase their market share overseas, so very much a market-driven logic, and then, of course, the government's desire for the expansion of that media. So we see different levels and kinds of involvement also in different countries. So we see in some countries, like, for instance, Zimbabwe, we will see much more involvement in building infrastructure, whereas in South Africa, for instance, where there's already sophisticated infrastructure, media infrastructure, the emphasis might fall more on commercial involvement or exchanges. So again, we should see this as a multifaceted strategy and not as a sort of a one-size-fits-all approach. So we should be careful and I also use the terms about China, Africa, but there are many different types of involvement of China, many different ways in which they are involved, and also many different ways in which Africa responds, different African countries with different types of engagement. So we can picture that this is sort of triangle. Content production is one area where China is involved in Africa. Content distribution, infrastructure development, and direct investment. So at least four different ways of thinking about that involvement, or four different dimensions to that involvement. So some of the initiatives, I think I'm not going to dwell on them too much because I think a lot of this is already quite well known, but the initiatives, Chinese media initiatives, include the expansion of Xinhua News Agency in African countries, China Central Television, CCTV, which also has a specific English language channel, but also has a specific focus on Africa, China Radio International, China Daily. All of these platforms have an increased presence, at least in the last decade. Xinhua Agency at last count at 23 bureaus in Africa, and often seen also as a cheaper alternative to Reuters, often providing their information to Reuters and AFP. And there's also a web version that's accessible through mobile. So all these different ways of accessing Xinhua that just purely for economic reasons would make more sense to African audiences. Commercial entities like Beijing Review in China Africa, which is recently established as a local company in South Africa aimed at local audiences. Again, that's more of a commercial emphasis. And then, as I've already mentioned, also exchange and training programs for journalists between China and Africa. So, again, various different types of engagement that we can see in playing out. So if we move the focus a bit more closer to South Africa, we can see some of those different dimensions also present in Chinese engagement in South Africa. So infrastructure development, you can see the top line there. Chinese telecommunications that have awarded a contract to expand Cell C, which is a local network, to expand their GSM network. Training, various training programs for journalists, participation in workshops for media officials and editors, these sort of exchanges going on. Content production, China Africa, I've already mentioned that. There's a relaunch of that magazine, a bilingual French and English magazine edited by a group based in a regional bureau in Johannesburg. Content distribution, Chinese-owned Star Times acquired On Digital Media's Top TV, which is a competitor for the more established MultiChoice, owned by Naspers. And while we're looking mostly at the Chinese involvement in Africa, we should also say that there's also a contraflow for the big South African company, Naspers, has made huge profits from its investment in Tencent in China, the Chinese web platform. So there's certainly not only a one-way flow, there's also a flow back. Maybe most interestingly, in recent years, in 2013, the direct investment took the form of the stakeholding in the purchase of the Independent Media Group, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later. And that's an example of this commercial involvement, where there's been a direct involvement, sort of direct investment in the purchase of the Independent Group that was formerly owned by O'Reilly. And that is also interesting because it provides us with a way of looking at how local politics shape the reception of Chinese involvement, and I'll speak about that a bit more later. So if we look at some of the debates, some of the implications, so those are some of the types of involvement, some of the dimensions of involvement. If we then move on to how this has been received, what debates have ensued as a result of these investments? And the first aspect that we could look at is Africa's media image. How Chinese involvement in Africa had also had implications for how Africa is viewed in global media discourses. And here I want to refer to colleagues in the audience, Mel Bunn, Suzanne Franks, and Chris Patterson's recent book on Africa's media image, that also outlines some of the recent developments in how Africa has, the image of Africa has changed in global debates. So most of us probably are aware of the historically negative coverage of Africa in the Western media, seen as a place of famine, war, and poverty. Economists' very notorious front page of the hopeless continent, which in recent years have improved to the extent that the Economists had a front page celebrating Africa Rising. And also followed by Time magazine and others, celebrating the sort of hopeful idea of Africa as rising. But critics have also pointed out how that positive image is also fed into a mediated construction of Africa as a market. So it's really fed by the same sort of neoliberal impulse that that in previous years showed Africa as hopeless. Now there's more market opportunities, and now Africa is seen as rising. It also coincides with the shift of media in Africa, foreign media in Africa, to emphasize much more business stories. So we also see that when Africa is reported on positively, it's often in terms of business. So it's, Reuters and other international media platforms spend much more of their time now focusing on business in Africa, and consequently also see Africa, frame Africa in these positive terms as an emerging market. So in this broader picture of initially very negative and later on very limited view of Africa as positive in terms of market opportunities, China's media has the potential to construct alternative frames, alternative ways of presenting Africa to a global audience. And this also coincides with the different approaches of Chinese reporting. That is often seen as... termed constructive reporting, so not the sort of critical watchdog reporting that we have associated mostly with Western approaches, but a more harmonious, less critical approach, which sometimes is seen as also problematic when you look at press freedom in Africa, which again I will return to shortly. So CCTV's aim, stated aim explicitly, is to present a more positive image of not only of Chinese involvement in Africa, so not only painting a more positive picture of what China is doing in Africa, but also a more positive picture of Africa, to promote ways of looking at Africa differently. So the West has covered you very negatively in the past, we'll provide a much more positive picture. What is also interesting, and this is how I think we can start seeing how Chinese engagement also highlights some of the international assumptions around Africa, is that this Western reporting of Sino-Africa engagement is often equally negative and also draws on Orientalist tropes of Africa as in need of saving. In other words, a sort of paternalistic, patronizing view of Africa as now falling foul of another imperialism. So the ways in which Chinese involvement in Africa is seen as bad for Africa also underestimates sometimes or underplays African agency in this relationship. So we can also see how this highlights again maybe unstated or implicit assumptions about Africa in the Western media. So if we do look at press freedom, we can see that Africa, Chinese involvement in Africa has been seen in a very negative light in the Western media. Just some examples there, and not only in the Western media, the last one there is my colleague, South African colleague. South African discourse is also very negative about the impact of China's involvement on press freedom. So you can see Mohammed Keita in a very controversial article in the New York Times wrote there, but the powerful political and economic interests ties to China investment in Africa seek to stamp out independent reporting. So a very critical, very negative view of what China is aiming to do in Africa. And you could see similarly there. And when we look at the South African picture specifically, a lot of this is also couched in terms of South Africa as a new democracy, a democracy of, you know, barely 20-odd years old, and that we fought hard for media freedom, and now the Chinese involvement, we risk eroding that hard-won freedom by getting into bed with Chinese media. So this is one of the dimensions of the discourse on Chinese media. Where this plays out very clearly is in this could be, I think, probably a case study for how these different interests coincide around specific cases, like the purchase of independent news and media. What happened here is in 2013, a consortium, local consortium, Sekunjalo Consortium, owned by Iqbal Survey, it's him there on the very blurry picture there at the bottom, put together a consortium to buy out independent media that had previously been owned by the Irish Independent PLC under Tony O'Reilly. That deal had been brokered by Nelson Mandela in the early 1990s in an attempt to diversify the South African press. So O'Reilly sought to divest, to get rid of those interests, and it was bought by the Sekunjalo Consortium. Now that consortium, there was initially wasn't clear where that funding came from, and gradually it also and I think this also needs to be said, that a lot of this, these sort of engagements or these transactions aren't always transparent, and it's very difficult to get information about how these transactions take place. And that also feeds into sort of a mistrust and a suspicion around Chinese involvement in Africa. But so when it came to light that a 20% stake in that purchase was owned by the China Africa Development Fund, which is a government-led investment group, and China International Television Corporation, which is the overseas arm of the Chinese state-run broadcaster, led to huge controversy in the South African press. Again, you saw that, to refer back to Anton Arbour's previous comment on the previous slide about how this involvement is not boding well for South African press freedom. You see there the bottom, Terry Bell, also respected labor journalist in South Africa, saying Survey's partnership with Chinese state propaganda television channel CCTV, the oxygen of democracy, media freedom, is clearly threatened. But when you start looking at the dynamics of this, you actually see that Chinese involvement here is seen as part of the problem, but that's not the main problem. The main problem is that Iqbal Survey, Iqbal Survey is very close to the ANC government. And so when Independent sets up an African news agency to circulate Xinhua content, that is seen as strengthening Survey's attack on press freedom in a broader sense. So what happened also was that Survey fired the Cape Times editor, Alida Danois. You see there was a protest in support of Alida Danois, Alida Continua, it says there. She was the previous editor of the Cape Times. She oversaw a issue of the Cape Times around the time of, or the, on the day of Nelson Mandela's death. And apparently that was the ruse, that they didn't give enough attention to Mandela's death. But in fact, what was behind this is that she also ran a story that was very critical of Sekunjalo, of Iqbal Survey's other businesses. So you see that Iqbal Survey's proximity to the ANC, his questionable editorial policies, all of that has already made him an enemy of South African supporters of press freedom, South African journalists. And so when his involvement in, or Chinese involvement in his purchase came to light, that was sort of fuel to the fire. So what we see is really a reaction, not in the first instance against China, but in the first instance against Iqbal Survey and his proximity to the ANC. So this shows us, I think, that there's a lot of sort of proxy debates, proxy discourses going on and that the Chinese involvement is seen through local lenses in the first instance, rather than as in terms of global flows and counterflows. So again, moving slightly more closer to the specific study that we did on South African journalists, we can see that the literature, the academic literature so far, has focused largely on content analyses. We've also done some of those, and I can speak about that in maybe in discussion time if you want, about how South African media have covered, have reported on Chinese involvement. The long and short of it is that actually it's usually seen in business terms, and when it's seen in business terms, it's sort of cautiously optimistic, but when it's seen in more political and cultural, social terms, it's very negative. Other academic literature focused on the sort of macro pictures, the political economy, the macro geopolitics, and we found that there's actually very little on the actual reception and production of journalism around. What are the conditions under which this engagement is viewed? And also, sort of how does this influence local journalists and their reporting? Questions remained really about how successful have Chinese soft power, how successful has this attempt been? So if China is trying to influence hearts and minds in South Africa through their media, is it working? Is it really being successful? And to try and measure that, we have to, I think, look at two different constituencies. One is journalists, because Chinese media, specifically CCTV, is aimed at an elite, is aimed at trying to influence local media discourses, and we have to look at general audiences. So we've conducted the study with journalists in the first instance. We are also did study with focus groups with audiences. We're still busy crunching that data, and hopefully that will be fit for consumption soon. But what this recent study with journalists have shown us also follows on previous studies with journalists, trying to find out three things. Firstly, do they use Chinese media? In other words, do they adopt Chinese media? Do they access Xinhua? Do they watch CCTV? And what are their attitudes towards that media? Secondly, how does that consumption, how does that impact on their journalistic practices? Does it change the way that they view China? Does it change the way that they practice journalism? Does it have an impact on their normative frameworks? And then also, thirdly, what are their views on South Africa-China relations more broadly? So those are the three thematic lines that we sought to pursue in our research. And we conducted in-depth interviews with journalists across various media, trying to answer these four research questions. As I've said, how often do media professionals in South Africa access content from Chinese media? Again, behind this, the underpinning sort of theory is what you could say Rees's hierarchy of influences, that journalists are influenced by a range of different sources of information, and that other journalism out there, other journalistic discourses partly influence journalist practice. So how often do they access content from Chinese media? What are their attitudes towards Chinese media? How much influence do those Chinese media companies have on journalism, especially also given independence involvement or Chinese involvement in independent? And how do media professionals in South Africa perceive Africa-China relations more broadly? We devised this sort of framework of analysis for those findings, alongside that sort of axis. So if you look at the top there, that would be a favorable view of Chinese media on the one end of the spectrum, and the bottom end, unfavorable view of Chinese media. And the sort of x-axis, on the one hand, non-adoption at all of Chinese media, and on the other end of that axis, adoption of Chinese media. So where can we plot journalists' views on that framework? And we suggested that we can sort of typology, where you can come up with sort of four different classes, different types of journalistic responses. So if you had a very favorable view of Chinese media and you adopted it, then you'd be a sort of adopter. Unfavorable view of Chinese media, a resistor or a pragmatist, you have an unfavorable view, but you still adopted it, you still used it, accessed it. and then on the other end of the spectrum, the unconvinced. And I'll give you some examples of those different ones. So adopters, these are the people that do adopt Chinese media and do integrate that into as a source in their work. So here's an example of one of them. It's a senior manager for a television station. He said, I do watch CCTV mainly, not as much as I ought to. So you see there's this sort of assumption that actually you should use it more. I think that Africa coverage is very good. I think it's good from the point of view that they clearly are investing. They have, I think, a stronger commitment to using local people than, say, CNN or BBC. And they tend to do stories that are not necessarily on the main agenda. So, no. Yes, I guess. I do watch CCTV. So that's an example of an adopter. Pragmatist, somebody that says, well, sort of skeptical maybe, sort of resistant, but that also realizes that you have to take heed of, you can't ignore Chinese media. So it says, let's assume that there's a growing criticism of land grab in Mozambique. Two or three Chinese business people were driven out of the country as a result of this and this demonstration in front of the Chinese embassy in Maputo, CCTV and the various newspapers in China. How would they react to that? They would be fairly relentlessly one-sided about it. In other words, sort of a critical meta-reading maybe of Chinese media, realizing that they will maybe be one-sided and be biased, but that they still need to be taken heed of, still need to be to see how Chinese media report, because that will add to the broader picture and enrich reporting. But then there's also a lot of resistors. Resistors would be somebody like this editor of a weekly paper saying there was a lot of contact with Chinese media, assuming, for instance, exchange programs or Chinese overtures. But I made it very clear to my employer that I did not care for the way in which that country is governed. I do not believe that it believes in human rights, and I do not believe in supping with the devil. So, no, I have nothing to say to them. They're a very strong resistance. And you see that often in popular discourses around China's involvement. And then there's also the unconvinced, saying, I don't exactly know the agency and how it works. So it's also just, and then prompted saying, it's called Xinhua. Oh, yes, I've read about it. So that's just generally ignorance. And then there's a lot of that as well. So there's a lot of ignorance, people that even don't even know where to access Chinese media. You tell them there is a channel on the digital satellite platform, then they're often surprised and they don't even know about it. So I think it's clear from this sort of our interviews with journalists that at the micro level, Chinese news media rarely shape content in South Africa. Although there's a big thrust, they rarely shape attitudes, perceptions, and that people don't actually even know where to go to access it. Although there is some indirect influence, there are some adopters and pragmatists who want a Chinese perspective on global affairs. They won't necessarily adopt that perspective, and they're very critical of it. On a sort of more macro level, I think there is a concern that especially independent has already adopted a softer stance on Chinese issues, and that there will be a long-term sort of filtering through of these attitudes, and that will be worrisome, and that in the future you'll see an erosion of sort of some of the more independent and sort of critical stances that South African media pride themselves on. Speaking to the journalists for the independent group, this is one, we didn't identify this person by their role, but they seem to say mostly that they don't see the Chinese as a threat. They believe that they have a strong culture, they are a more robust culture that will resist influence. And you sometimes also hear this from other journalists, that they say South African media are robust, they're vibrant, and they will resist influence from China, so there's no reason to really worry. But I think in general it is safe to say that there's skepticism that dominates the reception of South Africa-China relations, or skepticism about the South Africa-China relations in the media. And that, as I've already mentioned, in terms of Sekenjalo, the Chinese presence is decoded through domestic frames and lenses. We'll see that the Chinese involvement often comes up against resistance against people like a Survey, who is seen as very close to the ANC government. What we do see also, however, in this debate and the discourses around China and in Africa is that there's it prompts a sort of reflection and often also a reassertion of South African professional values in journalism. Again, highlighting some of the assumptions that South African journalists work with. So maybe we can also call it a type of paradigm repair, that we say that in this response to China in Africa, there's a renewed commitment to certain normative values like press freedom, independence, objectivity, watchdog journalism. So a reassertion, but not necessarily a critical examination of it. So it's a reassertion of certain values that might be very idealistic and might not even be practiced in any case. The next step for this would be audience reception. What we've done so far is conduct focus groups with the intended audiences, consisting of, for instance, policymakers, professionals, and media consumers of Chinese media. We're busy analyzing that. But our initial impressions are, again, that there's very little knowledge or exposure to Chinese media, but that there's also a preformed skepticism. So what we did, for instance, in some of the focus groups is show them clips of different channels covering the same thing. In this case, the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. So we'd show them clips of BBC, CNN, and CCTV, and mask the broadcast so they can't see which is which. And again, this is sort of anecdotally impressionistic. We're still busy finalizing it, but what we see is that there's, if they don't know that this is CCTV, they would say, well, this looks like a good report, looks professional and so on. But once you take that mask away and you say CCTV, say, no, that must be propaganda, it must be bias, can we, you know, we must, are you sure? Is this the one that we saw? And so on. So there's a sort of ingrained bias already, which makes it very difficult for this Chinese soft power to succeed among South African audiences, because that pre-existing view of China as Chinese television as propaganda is very deeply entrenched also among audiences, as it is largely also among journalists. So I think we can conclude to say that South African media professionals have varying degrees of engagement. It's not only rejection. There is some adopters, there's some pragmatists that view Chinese media, try to get a grip on it, try to see what the Chinese angle is on news and current affairs, but it is done with a very high degree of skepticism. Consequently, we can see the South African media professionals' work as very limited. There's a very limited impact from Chinese investment. Some journalists fear possibly negative, long-term negative consequences. There's a very strong belief in editorial independence and a very strong skepticism that what the Chinese journalism is doing in Africa runs contrary to that independence and objectivity. Whether that normative value is actually practiced is a different question, of course, but there's a very deeply entrenched belief in a certain watchdog, critical, investigative journalism, so also consequently a very deep skepticism. So despite this big push, despite this charm offensive, despite the soft power that Chinese media is meant to achieve in Africa, we can see, certainly in the South African context, very limited impact. And thirdly, I think when we try and understand this limited impact, we have to think about this not in the first instance maybe as a response against a global superpower coming into Africa, a global flow, but we first have to see how this is filtered through local, domestic lenses. And the independent media example is a good example of that, but there are also other ways of possible ways of viewing how local politics are impacting on this reception. So we have to, I think, view this global via the local in the first instance. And that is it for the moment. Just to highlight that if you're interested in our project and other papers, other articles that we've produced so far, There's the link on top there. There's a link to our university website, our department website, and as Nick has said, we are in a partnership with LSE at the moment, so you can go and read all about it there, and there's my email address if you want further discussion engagement. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Alex, for a very fascinating and rich talk. We'll pass over directly to Clinton for her response, and then we'll open it to questions.
Thank you, Harmon, for a great lecture. I really enjoyed it, and there's so much, one can say. And I will try to be brief. I think I'm maybe going to make four comments, and each of these would be also followed by a question, but you don't have to answer all of them because we do want to open up for the audience to ask for more questions. I think my first comment I really appreciate what you said at the beginning, emphasizing the historical perspective, looking at China-Africa relation. And certainly China's presence in Africa didn't start from 2006 when the government started using the term, soft power. And if you ask Chinese people growing up in the 1960s and 70s, for example, my parents' generation, if you ask them what they know about China's relationship with Africa, I suppose many of them, the first example that many of them would think of is the Tanzania and Zambia Railway. And if you think about the whole historical background, including the investment that China put in there and the personnel and professional that the Chinese government sent there, and also the fact that was during the Cultural Revolution when China itself was going through great economic difficulty. So that was how the previous generation understand this relationship. So in that regard, I think when you say that in recent years there's intensification, and I think probably there's also a crucial shift, because at that time, that kind of aid or that kind of collaboration or help was really not framed in economic terms. It's not something that follows the market logic. It doesn't, even make sense from the economic point of view. And I think in the recent wave of, China's expanding its presence in Africa, the critique is really centering on this kind of market logic. That is it about the new wave of colonization, or is China just going to the countries where they're are the resources. So I think that is a key shift. And I think that maybe a useful reference point was during the weekend, I was also looking at news media, both the mainstream and social media's response to the death of Fidel Castro. And Sean Jacob wrote a great piece on his blog site, Africa is a Country, saying, he opened the piece by saying, if Africa was a country, Fidel Castro would be considered as one of the national heroes. And he recounted what happened, what Cuba did during to fight against apartheid, and how Mandela had a very close relationship with him. And also, Cuba was the first country that Mandela visited as soon as he came out of the prison. And there's this very interesting and also very illustrative quote here when the U.S. was criticizing Mandela for moving too close with this dictator. And Mandela responded that, he said, "We are now being advised about Cuba by people who have supported the apartheid regime these last 40 years. No honorable man or woman could ever accept advice from people who never cared for us at the most difficult times." But I think it would be probably difficult for any African leader to say something about China in the same way if they were criticized nowadays in their collaboration with the Chinese government. So to follow up on this comment, I'm just wondering whether the kind of ethos of the Third World Alliance against imperialism or colonialism or this internationalism is it's completely gone? Is it completely now replaced by this, you know, discourse about the market is all about economy, it's about getting the resources from Africa? Or are there conscious efforts made by either the Chinese or African media professionals to build a counter-hegemonic discourse? Because if you want to talk, if you talk about this expansion as kind of defense charm, that there's so much hostile, you know, the discourse about China, I don't think China is ever able to beat BBC or CNN at their own game if they always follow their way of defining, for example, democracy, defining the relationship between politics and press, and, you know, their way of defining free speech and freedom of press. So I'm just wondering whether there are any conscious effort trying to redefine the more fundamental issues rather than just, you know, I think if you don't do that, you're always on the defense, and it's there's no way that you can win that game if you don't try to redefine the rule of the game itself. And secondly, I have to confess that this is not really my area of research, and I did a bit of a reading, and I found actually quite a large number of studies, including studies commissioned by the government or commissioned by Xinhua. So I looked at this report done by the research center of Xinhua News Agency, and they had this assessment about Chinese media's opportunities and challenges in Africa. And so this is how they talk about opportunity. Three main things. One is that local African media is underdeveloped. And secondly, Chinese media are more sympathetic toward Africa, have competitive advantage in offering alternative news angle. And thirdly, Chinese ICT companies already lay the infrastructure for transmitting Chinese media content, for example, digital television. And the way they talk about challenge is, first of all, it's a diverse market. There's diverse demand. Chinese media only have limited knowledge about Africa. And they also talk about the legacy of colonialism, that people in Africa are more familiar with Western culture and Western perspective. So I'm also wondering if you, you know, look at this assessment and look at now, compare that with your study looking at how African media professionals assess Chinese media's presence and expansion in Africa. What are some congruence or incongruence between the Chinese assessment of their, you know, opportunities and challenges, and the way that African professionals look at it.
Okay.
And thirdly, I thought it's also really, you also made this really good point about how the decoding is done through a local, a domestic lens. And I suppose we see that always with the reception of international media coverage in different parts of the world. And I think, again, I want to refer to a study done on the Chinese side looking at how African media report on China. And I think, again, that's an example of how the decoding is done through domestic lens, that at the end of the study, so the key points they emphasize is that the China model is mainly about success in the economy, and it's about how African countries can learn from the Chinese model. And also you talk about, the Chinese visitors are always welcome in Africa, but it also talk about how sources are dominated by African and American ones in the African news production. And I thought also, since you, and this is, you know, maybe more of what you call the upstairs, the relationship. But also there is, you also mentioned this, the downstairs relationship things, you know, and we know that, for example, in the city of Guangzhou in southern China, there's a large African population, and there's part of Guangzhou that has the nickname Chocolate City. And there has also been research done from the cultural and anthropological perspective looking at how the local Chinese perceive the presence of these African migrants. And there are, of course, all kind, you know, a critical assessment of how, you know, there's the strong presence of racist, you know, the perspective and such. So I'm wondering how this, you know, sort of the equivalence in the African context, how Africans, you know, perceive the presence of increasing presence of Chinese in their, you know, the, in their daily life. What the interactions are like there. And then final point, I think it's interesting that you developed that kind of matrix about different kinds of attitude toward Chinese media. And I think there's also analogy you see there if you talk to Chinese media professionals, that their attitude toward, even for those who are working for official, you know, governed media organizations, they, many of them would also have a very critical view about, you know, I think in a way, it's sometimes I think of them as being in this kind of schizophrenic state. You know, if you talk to them in person, and then they seem to take on different persona when they start writing for Xinhua and writing, doing report for CCTV, as opposed to if you talk to them privately. So I think for a lot of Chinese media professionals, they are also still navigating an increasingly complicated political and ideological environment. So in that regard, I'm curious to know, although it's not really the focus of this study, but I'm wondering whether you've looked at the kind of training that Chinese media organizations are providing to some African media professionals. I'm curious to know what kind of training materials they provide, you know, what kind of training they offer. Because it seems to me that if you talk to the Chinese media professionals, they themselves are also having a hard time navigating the impact of the digital media technology, and also navigating a complicated and also many of would perceive as a hostile, you know, international discursive environment.
Thank you very much, Bing Chen.
Well, we want to bring in your questions, so I'm sure Herman will come back on those points later. Who would like, we've got about nearly just over 25 minutes, who would like to ask a question of Herman?
Right, we've got quite a few now. We have
I haven't got a piece of. Do you want to see if you just turn around? I'll show you one side. Do you mind if I use your brown side?
So, we have, first of all, we had it from the gentleman in the front, and then saw you. What the question?
Looking at all your study, I realized that there's an aspect which I kind of missed in terms of, I think generally speaking, the South African media is seen overwhelmingly as this left. There's this talk about it being liberal, predominantly white-owned media. And of course, within that composition, there is a historical inherent opposition to what would be colonialism, stroke, Chinese relationships, and how you see the political scene changing in South Africa, leaning more towards the left. Now, I'm keen to kind of find out how you came to this, because I see that element kind of missing in the study, in terms of how that composition imbalance is still inherent in society, meaning that chances of that old narrative being perpetuated still exists. And I'm keen to find out how you kind of went about deciding whether or not to improve that.
Great, thank you very much.
I think until the questions start flooding in, we'll take them one at a time. We may have to speed up, but
Herman, do you want to respond to that and of course pick up anything relevant from Bing Chen's response?
Yeah, I think there's so many different aspects that need further discussion. I mean, I think just pretty briefly to pick up on Bing Chen's points, I think what we see here is that we cannot speak about one response. African response, or even a South African response, that happens on so many different levels. So, for instance, I think what is often also missing is the criticism of African audiences and news consumers also against the Western media. So there's one example that came up with was, for instance, in Kenya, there was sort of hashtag someone tell CNN, you know, in terms of critical about CNN reporting as well. So in all of this, without going into too much detail now, I think when as you look at various different responses, and again, there's the response by the media, but then there's also responses by ordinary, so-called ordinary people, and just the upstairs and downstairs point of view. I mean, and that's not my term, by the way. It's Chris Alden and Yu-Yong Park's term about upstairs and downstairs. But one of the responses, for instance, is a very violent response, very xenophobic response. And in a recent book by Poplack and Bloom on what they call continental shift, tracking examples of Chinese investment in different parts of Africa, the leitmotif in that narrative is an example in South Africa where Chinese shopkeepers were burned to death in the shop. So, I mean, there's also a level of very violent xenophobic response. But to come to the point of maybe about the history and that both the history of the resistance to communism within a sort of Western white liberal owned media narrative, if I understand you correctly, also linking to the history of the Transam Railway, for instance. I think, again, we look at contested histories and how they play out, continue to play out in contestations. So you would get, I think, on the political level, maybe in the ANC, where the ANC would be much more, I think, reminiscent of those old loyalties and the Pan-African ideals of a resistance against apartheid, of which the Transam Railway was an example. And yes, I think in the more liberal media, more liberal paradigms, there that resistance against communism, the Chinese as a example of a, and also Orientalism, very sometimes just plain racism, does play a role. But I think, again, one should, I think it's more productive to view it through a local lens of what is happening at the moment. So the resistance, a strong resistance in the South African media against renewed attempts to clamp down on freedom of expression by the ANC, for instance, the proposed Media Appeals Tribunal, the so-called Secrecy Bill, the Protection of State Information Bill, so what are perceived as new attempts by the government to clamp down. And when they see this sort of partnership with China and the ANC, that just exacerbates that resistance. So, yes, there's partly historical legacies, I think, but I think predominantly, I would say, it's viewed through contemporary politics and the media stance contemporary against so contemporary government interference in the media as well.
Okay, thanks. There's a question there, and then we'll come. Yes, lady in the front, then we'll come back. No. Yes.
Okay.
I saw you, I don't know who's exactly.
Thank you very much for an interesting talk. I'm interested in the media assistance that China is giving to sub-Saharan Africa. I don't know if you can give us an estimated size of that compared to, say, the more conventional Western donors like USAID or DFID, who have fairly substantial media assistance programs. And picking up on your respondent's your question about the nature of that and the training side of it, just say a little bit more, be interesting.
Okay. Are we taking one by one? Or are we just
still one by one. Okay. We'll see how they do.
So, I mean, I think the media assistance takes different forms. Although there's these exchanges, and also to come back to Bingxuan's point about what is in this curricula, I think that is a good area of research that I haven't done, but I think that's more on the level of just sort of friendly, you know, establishing links, exchanges, and shortened programs rather than maybe aimed at a specific, inculcating a specific set of values. The media assistance have largely been, I think, in terms of infrastructure. And so, for instance, support for radio stations, building radio stations, equipment, that sort of assistance. Whereas I think that's also, historically, the West have done that, but there's been more, explicit sort of training, soft power, Western soft power through media assistance in the past. So there's a different, I think the Chinese involvement has been more sort of under the radar, if you want to call it that, by providing infrastructure and equipment. But there are, I mean, Yu Shanwu wrote an article that outlines that I can refer you to that maybe sort of outlines that in much more detail than I can do, sort of the specifics of that assistance. But my impression is that it's largely more in terms of infrastructure development.
Okay. Well, there were two questions there. And another one here, right? So we'll take these two together. It's okay.
So I lived in China. I went around to it quite a bit as well. And what I noticed is that the media, the positivity of like China, African relations isn't reciprocated so much as you were saying earlier. You know, I go to shops or whatever, and they say to me, "Oh, Bushi Kwan, Fedorin." Like, I don't like Africans, you know, that kind of thing. The blatant racism was just a lot to take. And it's shocking to me because when Africa's portrayed to China in a certain way, they're scared of us. But then when it's the other way, when it's in Africa, it's, you know, we're helping these people, blah, blah, and all these things. And so that's one thing that sort of irks me. And, you know, I wanted to ask, maybe, do you think that a country that doesn't really advocate for freedom of speech or doesn't really truly believe in voicing the opinions of the average man or woman is capable or should be allowed to be in control of another person's media? It doesn't make any sense to me, if I'm honest. And I feel that they're taking advantage of African countries and the fact that they're corrupt. China's also corrupt as well, and that's just a fact. I feel like they are indeed taking advantage. Am I the only one that sees that here? Because it's really confusing to me. You know, it's a very confusing thing, this whole China media thing for me, and lots of people as well. So, yeah, I want to know if corruption plays a massive role in the way the media is portrayed, how they portray Africa and China.
Okay, thanks. That's an important point. We'll take the next question as well.
So also just like to build on that point and maybe specify a little bit more. Like you mentioned a lot about African migrants of the working class in China, in the Southern Province, and what we see in sort of like a Chinese investment in Africa. It's like it's a different kind of social class. So do you see the difference in social class of being, does that influence the perception of like both ways, the country, China and Africa versus Africa and China? And my second question is, I'd be interested if you can expand a little bit more on the consultation process of Chinese media entering in African countries. Do all media companies, do they follow a particular Chinese strategy, or do you see a different success models of Chinese media in Africa?
Okay, thanks. Difficult questions. Well, firstly, around racism of Chinese racism, I think that it has been pointed out also Howard French, for instance, in his book China's Second Continent, he's quite critical of picking up on those instances. And you know, a lot of that has already been mentioned there in Guangzhou. I know there's been clashes as well. There's racism is something that you could certainly pick up in some of the relationship. But I mean, I think racism is not hard to find in a country like South Africa. So we don't, you know, there's certainly a dimension there. But xenophobia is also very prevalent in South Africa. So it sort of cuts both ways. But your point about the coverage of Africa or South Africa in Chinese media, again, I think there's a lot of ground for further study there. Media Tenor, the media analysis company, has a few years back, I remember seeing analysis of that coverage, and it confirms what you mentioned. There's very negative coverage of South Africa. Crime is high on the list of, you know, on the agenda. Yeah, I mean, I'm speaking about the South African context. So I think that certainly is from the little bit that I've seen in terms of analysis of Chinese media of coverage of Africa, that it seems to be true. But there's, I think, more scope for further research. So your question around whether that should, I mean, that's a normative question that, you know, we can say yes, whether it should or not. But I think what is maybe also interesting is to expand this and say that, are we also directing the same sort of level of scrutiny to other, I mean, looking at media assistance previously, for instance, historically, of the US in South Africa or in Africa, are we also scrutinizing the sort of soft power assumptions underpinning Western involvement in Africa to the same extent? So that, if we talk about sort of normatively, that's a question that I would ask. I didn't quite understand the question around social class, but I think different models of engagement, I think, yes, there are different, and we can also just look at empirically at the different types of things that China has done in African media. Sometimes it's infrastructure, sometimes it's exchange programs, sometimes it's direct commercial investment. So I think it depends on, again, the different African countries. So the approach that they will take, the sort of consultation that you, whether you use consultation, but the approach, the strategy will differ depending on the recipient country. The same approach that they took in Zimbabwe, for instance, will not work in South Africa, and vice versa. So I think that it depends largely on the context.
But is there a consultation with the public before like media companies enter, or is it usually with some media companies already there in the country, or with governments? I'm just curious.
Yeah, there's no public consultation. It depends on the type of engagement. So if it's a commercial engagement, like in the case of Second Jalo, that would be a sort of a company, sort of largely in terms of a company agreement. And in other cases, it might be between universities. For instance, something that we haven't mentioned, for instance, the Confucius Institutes, also a large part of the soft power and at South African universities, for instance. So very different types of levels and different types of engagement. But I don't think that, and that's also partly what makes research in this area very difficult, is that there's not a lot of transparency, and it's very difficult to get behind the front. So very difficult to find out exactly what is transpiring in those negotiations.
Okay, thanks. We had a question here in the front, and then one.
Hello, I think my question is for both of you. So I'm very interested in the phenomenon that Ms. Mok mentioned about this divergence between consciousness and behavior of the African officials. They critically think of some of China's behavior in Africa, but they still follow it, as you said, that they speak one way on the national TV, but they...
Oh, I was talking about Chinese media officials. I wasn't talking about Africans.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, I misunderstand that. But yeah, my research is also about the African audience, not CCTV Africa. So this is one of the phenomena I've noticed about this divergence between consciousness and behavior. So I think the reason of this kind of divergence is because probably the African, well, the journalists or audience officials, they don't see an alternative way of developing their own countries. But to that context is to say Sino-African economic cooperation hasn't provided a alternative to the dominant global neoliberalist capitalist development mode. But the problem is that China is still claiming itself as a socialist country. So, I mean, how can researchers in this context deal with this kind of a theoretical gap or theoretical distortion? So that is basically my question.
Good, thank you very much. And then a question over here. The lady in the green scarf.
Hello. I, largely on your inspiration, Herman, I'm trying to write a paper about reception of Chinese activities in Tanzania. And so I spent 7 years living there on and off, talking to colleagues, because I'm a journalist as well, and to friends. And I'd just like to echo the young woman's comment from Nigeria about sort of cynicism and feeling slightly used and exploited, because that's the experience that a lot of people I talk to. And I wondered if you encountered a kind of the dominant response that people say, it's a very knowing, yeah, well, this is just, you know, of course people are going to build airports, they're going to build roads because they can, they're very good at it, and this is what they do. Nothing in it for us. And our newspapers are going, I'm summarising kind of a lot of different nuances, but this is the general gist of it. And there are, we're only going to see some press reports about, you know, how wonderful China is, because it's elites talking to elites. So there was a very cynical, quite nuanced understanding of what the power relationships were between China and Tanzania in that case. And I wondered if in your research you would break it down at all to, you know, say there's a massive difference between a local reporter in her 20s who's working freelance on a, you know, on a zine or on a blog and who's quite street, for a better word, and then some, you know, diehard yada yada Afrikaans guy who's been there forever and is interested to completely maintain the status quo. Did you not see any kind of diversity and knowingness, a sense of, you know, well, this is what the leaders do. They do their bridging, you know, P2P, platform to platform, whatever, G2G stuff, and we hover around, and, you know, or did you not break it down? It's kind of slightly echoing really what that young woman was saying, but there's a cynicism about, I found, you know, about what China's doing.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm being generous.
Do you want to start?
Do you want to respond to this question?
Yeah, maybe I can start with that. I mean, I'll start with that. I think there certainly is cynicism. I think the question is, how do we systematically do that research? I mean, anecdotally, if you speak to the person in the street, yes, you would hear those sort of things. The question for me would then be, if there's a cynicism against this sort of government-to-government, about this government-to-government relations, is that cynicism in the first instance born out of a cynicism against the Tanzanian government or against the South African government or against the Chinese government? So, I mean, is this compounding, is this amplifying already existing criticism or disillusionment with the Tanzanian government? So, again, to use your word unpacking, I think there's a lot of unpacking to do, and just seeing this as a cynicism directed against China in the first instance, I think is not necessarily particularly helpful, although it does feed into it. And again, if that cynicism is pre-existing, as we have found with the audience studies, where does that come from? It has come from a deep-seated Orientalist distrust of, you know, a culture that people know very little about. Does it come through a long-term exposure to Western discourses in the media? So where did that come from? How does it? So I would be careful just to say there's just a rejection of China per se. There's a lot of other dimensions to that rejection or that cynicism. Similarly, if we look at xenophobia, for instance, in South Africa, and there's a lot of studies around xenophobia. There's xenophobia against Chinese immigrants, but there's also xenophobia against Somalians, against Ethiopians, and so not a lot against Germans. So because there's an economic disparity, there's limited resources in the townships where they compete for very limited resources. So again, is this a xenophobia that is born out of the type of involvement, type of economic involvement that Chinese immigrants largely have? Cheap 5 rand stores in townships where they and Ethiopian shops competing for with local residents that engage in similar economic activities. So again, xenophobia also is not a simplistic picture. Just to come back to the question, and I can't remember exactly how it was phrased around markets, but I think one point that I wanted to make is, and Colin Sparks has made this point, I think another interesting insight that we can gain from studying China-Africa relations or just Chinese global aspirations is that it forces us or prompts us to critique some of our long-standing assumptions around media and democracy. For instance, the marketization of China has been a state-driven marketization,
but it's a state-driven marketization of the media. So the assumption that a democratic media and a market-driven media are always intrinsically linked is not the case. So it forces also to think about how marketization in a global neoliberal economy is not always necessarily married to democracy in the way that maybe a lot of Western theoretical models lead us to believe. So it also prompts us to critique some of those inherited theoretical models about media, democracy, and society.
We've got time for one or two more questions. There's a question here and one down there.
Hello. The battery has gone.
Oh, has it?
Yeah.
Oh, we'll just speak louder. Just we're just trying louder. To record the question so for the tape.
Hello, Mr. Harmon. My question is, you mentioned that the coverage about Africa by the Chinese media could be positive, while historically the image of Africa in the Western media is mostly negative. So by doing this, it seems to me that the Chinese media can do a better job in pleasing the local African audience. Pleasing. So I'd like to know, what are your comments on the strategy of reporting Africa that the Chinese media is using?
Okay, and we'll just take the question back there. Sorry, because the microphone's not working, you'll have to speak loud. Sorry. We'll try and record.
Thank you very much for Professor Harmon's beautiful presentation. And my question is, maybe similar to the girl's argument, since China tends to apply a constructive approach to Africa, and I think what it is against is not only the negative, like Western media's portrayal of Chinese image, it is also the Western journalism norms. It is like the news selection criteria, like novelty and dramatization. When it comes to Western democracy, the dramatization and novelty always come to like the arguments and debates between politicians. It's the image of democracy. But when it comes to Africa, it is famine, poverty. When it comes to China, it must be in lack of human rights and lack of freedom of speech. So I think maybe domestically, the Western journalism norms is still works. Like to criticize the corrupt government, of course, the Chinese government, it is to some extent. But if we always apply this kind of criteria in international news media, then China and Africa will never escape this dilemma in Western media's portrayal. How do you think we can nail this problem?
Okay, thank you. Maybe I can sort of summarize the two questions in terms of. So what this sounds to me is about news values, sort of Western news values, professional practices, and how Chinese values and practices differ, and how what the response would be to that. In the first instance, I think we should be very wary of establishing the sort of binary between China and the West, because there are also very many different types of Western journalism, Western approaches. Ranging from communitarian journalism, public journalism in the U.S., to and if you read Helen and Mancini's work about different models, I mean, so we have to be careful about just making that binary distinction. But if you talk about a particular brand of Western journalism or sort of watchdog journalism, which is often contrasted against maybe what is unfairly seen as a Chinese model of positive reporting, I think it is a double-edged sword in terms of. The African, its involvement in Africa, because partly CCTV's sort of selling point is that we will provide a more positive, promote a more positive image of Africa than the West has done. But that very approach is also seen as a reason for cynicism against the Chinese journalists, because they say, oh, well, they're just propaganda. We will only believe and trust journalism from the BBC that is critical and independent and neutral. And all those sort of terms that in themselves are also problematic. Of course, the whole history of objectivity is a problematic one. But so it's a double-edged sword in the sense that it can provide a more positive picture, but for that very reason also might be mistrusted. Another dimension to that, I think, that we have to bear in mind is that there's also a certain aesthetic to this sort of watchdog critical journalism. That's become a sort of stock approach, and that extends beyond just Western, beyond the BBC and CNN, etc. If you look at how Al Jazeera, just the aesthetics of Al Jazeera, for instance, it is a certain aesthetic that comes across as sort of a hard-nosed, hard-edged sort of investigative, you know, reporting that is not only necessarily a normative value, but it is a certain news aesthetic. And I think CCTV has in recent years tried to emulate that more and more, so it becomes more difficult to distinguish when you mask that to audiences. But again, that's partly the difficulty also why South African audiences certainly have a certain maybe gut response against the broadcasts that are seemingly positive and sunshine journalism, and they mistrust that. So, again, it might be an attempt to make inroads into African audiences or South African audiences, but I think it backfires. I think it's seen as actually confirming the bias or confirming the perception that Chinese media is propagandistic.
Final comment
to you, Ping-Chun? I'm aware of the time, so just very briefly, I think the schizophrenic status of many media professionals in China is only a reflection of the schizophrenic status of the regime itself. Because I think, again, if using the news that took place over the weekend as an example, yes, the Chinese president issued an official sort of obituary to mourn the death of Fidel Castro. But if you look at the Chinese media, a lot of media outlets, in their assessment, they don't have anything much positive and positive things to say about Castro and about this, and even less than some of the left-leaning media in the Western context, in their assessment, in their more historical assessment, including the economic hardship that, you know, Cuba has been going through, including what happened, you know, when there was internationalism, when Cuba provided a lot of support for the fight against apartheid, including the fact that Cuba also sent the largest medical group team during the Ebola. You don't even see that kind of. So, again, the top level, the official, they have to maintain this tone. But actually, you know, in that regard, I think you can say, you know, the regime itself has really lost the hegemony in the Gramsci sense, and that's why you see all this kind of whether you call it divergence or the schizophrenic status.
Okay, well, we've come to the end. I hope you'll be able to join us for a drink afterwards and continue the discussion. But let's thank Ping-Chun for a very stimulating response and
Thank
the bubble
you.
Herman
Thank
for
you.
A subtle and fascinating talk.
Thanks for the pin.